Welcome to LSE Limelight from the Beaver Sound, where we unfold the best stories from students around LSE, this time with me, Beatrice, and Maisie. In this episode, we spoke with the Students' Union General Secretary, David Gordon, about what the past year has been like for him in his role, what he managed to achieve, and what difficulties he's faced along the way in a very unusual year.
Hi, David. Thank you for coming. It's a really good opportunity for us to chat to you today. This year was very different, obviously, from what everyone expected. We just wanted to discuss what it was like for you as General Secretary to lead the student union and to adapt to all these new changes. So I'm going to start by asking you, what were your plans? So I'll start by asking you, what were your top priorities for this year coming into the role?
It's a really good question. My top priority definitely changed as the pandemic unfolded, because obviously the election happened just at the time we all went into the first UK lockdown. And my top priority had been about the strategy in the union and really making the union work in a better way. And I think for me, there'd been a lot of investment in clubs and societies and getting support really good in that area. The advice service has always been really excellent within the union. Where I saw a need for improvement was around our commercial outlets, making them more in line with what students wanted, and actually having a much better catering offer to societies, many of whom were throwing, you know, large scale events with lots of public officials attending, and our catering offer didn't quite match that. And then second to that, the big priority was in the representation team. I think a lot of students don't actually connect the union with a political representative force that it could be. And that's something I wanted to change. I've been able to tinker a little bit, but not as much as I'd have liked to. Obviously, with the commercial element, that's the gym, bars, cafes. Lockdown, successive lockdowns since have made it quite difficult to think about how to improve those services. Our focus has been on how do we keep them alive in this context? We just need to make sure, you know, the gym can be open when it's allowed to be open, stuff like that. Much, much more than being able to think about, you know, how we market these services in a broader context, changing the overall offer. It was about sticking to the core offer. And then the political representation side, I think we've improved a little bit, but it feels like ad hoc improvement. It feels like we've been a lot more reactive to where students are at this year, because the pandemic has made it a bit easier to tell where students are at. It's brought some of the core issues into focus, like halls rebates, fee compensation, graduation being something that's come up very recently. But that was kind of my big priority, was trying to set some shape for the union, trying to reorient its strategy, which is something we're actually doing at the moment. And been able to tinker a little bit, but not in the fullest way I'd have liked to.
So you talked about how your priorities changed, obviously, because of the pandemic. Do you think the pandemic offered any opportunities to kind of reorient your priorities and for you to tackle some other issues that came with it?
Yeah, I think, and you guys will probably have a better sense of this than me as students, but I think the union came a bit closer to students this year. I think particularly since January with the third UK lockdown, I think you've heard from us a little bit more. We've definitely been hearing from students more, and it's been a bit closer. Our understanding of where students are at matched with our work on behalf of students has been a bit better. And I think that's something I'd have liked to see, and the pandemic created quite a good backdrop for that. There's a lot of bad that came with the pandemic. There's a lot of ways in which it wasn't that brilliant. And I'm trying to think of ways that it's helped. I think it's, weirdly, I sit here every day, every working day, right? And I just have my laptop and I move from meeting to meeting by going into a different Zoom room or a Teams chat, stuff like that. It's made it a lot easier to be connected to people at LSE specifically. When we're on campus, we're in the office space and we're quite separate in the SU office compared to the rest of campus. I feel a lot closer to people at LSE, which has allowed us to have a lot greater influence in the shape of policy at the university. So one example is, you may or may not have heard of, though, they were thinking about using online proctoring software, which is artificially intelligent software that would sort of read your behavior as you were taking your exam, listening to your audio. Freaky stuff. that we really don't want students to be a part of. Because we were online, I think we were much more able to identify the allies at LSE and work with them. Whereas previously, you know, you'd have to book in-person meetings. I was in a situation where we would just sort of call people on an ad hoc basis and be able to work together, put some joint proposals forward. And that's just one example where I think our ability to work with people at the school got a lot better. And our ability to kind of see what's going on has improved. But that might also be because I became the general secretary. And so I have exposure to a lot of what's going on. I think that's probably one of the main opportunities the pandemic brought, and particularly working from home.
Okay, so I know that before you were the Gen Sec, I never know how to say that word, but I know that before that you were the community and welfare officer, if I'm right. There was speak about the homelessness mission, obviously at LSE, and in light of COVID, I wanted to ask you, how's that been going? What's happened there? Because, you know, a few of the people who actually want to take over from you now, and indeed the position you had last year, are quite keen for there to be more of a look at the homelessness in the area of LSE, because obviously there's a lot of it. What could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic initiative. It brings together essentially the Students' Union, LSE and St Mungo's, which is the largest homelessness charity in the country, and they do some fantastic work. It's been a bit tough. You know, the opportunities for in-person volunteering haven't been what we'd have liked them to be. We had planned to run a kind of careers fair for people experiencing homelessness in the local area. What St Mungo's do is they're sort of like a full service for people rough sleeping or experiencing homelessness. They have this whole education centre. They try and really rehabilitate people so they can join society in a more conventional way, and we were hoping to join them at the tail end of that in helping people get jobs, essentially, and use the background that LSE has in that. We haven't been able to do some of those really exciting things, but fundraising has been able to go ahead. There's currently a scheme which the SU should be communicating about later this week or next week about donating your commute, noting that we're not going into campus anymore. You know, donating that £5 you might have used to go in and out today would be really good. One of the elements is research, trying to bring the world-class research that LSE has to St Mungo's. But it's interesting, St Mungo's has been so overwhelmed with everything the pandemic has brought up, trying to support their community, that they've kind of almost not had the time to really direct our research. And it's been really important that we're directed by St Mungo's, not that we say this should happen and therefore we go and do it. St Mungo's need to tell us that, because otherwise it became really clear really early on that we could end up mismatching our offer. We could end up researching things, putting on events that just didn't really help and were maybe made us look good, but wouldn't actually have beneficial impact. I think there's a real opportunity, not just in this, but for every facet of university life and the way LSE works for the officer team that come in next year. Hopefully the vaccine rollout is good and life goes back to some kind of normal. And I think the homelessness partnership, among with many other things, will just, so you'll be able to get so much done. And there's so much appetite to make good things happen, because it's been a bit of a slog the last 12 months.
So before you were community and welfare officer, I don't know if it was the rugby society that you were part of. Am I right in thinking this? You had a whole sort of campaign, I can't remember what it was called, but it was about addressing, you know, lad culture and that kind of side of the academic union. Am I right in thinking this? This seems like a distant memory for me, so I thought I'd clarify it with you. No, but that was something that happened.
What year are you in, by the way?
Oh, I'm in second year.
Okay, cool. So this is like talking about before you even joined LSE, I guess.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'll tell you my story, my background with rugby. I joined in first year. I hated it, because there was a lot of bullying, there was a really toxic culture, I thought. I played into that, you know. There was a part of me as quite an impressionable first year that saw what was going on, saw these older guys doing this stuff and thought it was quite fun. But within the sort of first 5-6 weeks of term, I realised it wasn't for me, and that if I followed the rugby club in that direction, I was going to turn into a person I didn't really want to be. So I dropped out. I went and did mixed lacrosse for the rest of the first year, and I absolutely loved it. then the leadership in the rugby club changed. The guys who were in charge just weren't bullies, and it was brilliant. And there was a much more inclusive, you know, it was still men's rugby, which is, so it's not to say that it was a perfectly inclusive culture, but it was much better than it had been. And it meant I felt comfortable enough to keep playing, because I do love playing rugby. I just didn't love a lot of the stuff that went on off the pitch. And then I got to third year, and I was the outreach officer. I'd got elected as the outreach officer, and I realised there's actually an opportunity for us to take some leadership in challenging some of the more toxic behaviours that exist within our club and within the athletics union more broadly. So we organised, and I'll tell you, I don't think it was successful. We made things happen, but I wouldn't call it a success overall. The SU was working to get consent education made available through LSE, and LSE weren't doing it. And I thought, well, hang on, why don't men's rugby facilitate consent education? Because that's really bad. If the university's not doing it, it's so bad that men's rugby is coming along and putting on some consent education. That tells you that not only is there demand, but the university's really not doing its job. So we hired a professional facilitator who came in and delivered a session for leaders of AU clubs. The session itself was really great, and we had some really good conversations with, I think at the time, particularly the club captain of men's football and a few other of the male clubs, really talking about how they felt that there was this real tension as the leader of clubs to put on the really laddie behaviour for the rest of the club. And there was this real push and pull that was being talked about, recognising, you know, we're third years, we're supposed to be a bit better than this, but this is what the membership of the club's looking for. And that was a really positive conversation. The reason why I say it wasn't overall a success is it didn't go anywhere. There was no follow-up. We had a vague commitment to improve stuff. We talked about writing some codes of conduct for our clubs, but the inevitable sort of assessment cycle of LSE got in the way, and it kind of dissipated. But that was a background to running for community and welfare officer, where I thought I have a sense of what the union could benefit from. But then, and we started, it takes a while to get going in the SU as an officer to really work out what you're trying to achieve and how best to achieve it. And we started running at the beginning of 2020, some really cool sessions with lots of the leaders from throughout the athletics union, where we really talked about how we wanted the culture to change. And they were really positive sessions. Then the pandemic came along, and the kind of the work that we'd been building to was lost. We weren't interacting in person, and other things superseded it as a priority, which was a shame. So I've kind of gone all over the place there, but hopefully
that's great to hear, because what I was meant to ask you, but I suddenly remembered that I was talking to you, is that I was aware of this, that you came off the back of that really. But I wanted to ask you about the independent sexual health advisor that the SU was pushing to get, and I wondered if that had happened.
Yeah, so all credit goes to Laura, our fantastic community and welfare officer, and I've been so lucky to play a supporting role in her making this happen. Been through a journey. For a while, it looked like the school wasn't going to make it happen. I could go into quite a lot of detail, so I'll try and keep it general enough that it will sort of make sense. The process for survivors getting support who've been through instances of sexual violence is abysmal at LSE, and it has been abysmal for a very long time, in my opinion. Laura put in a motion maybe like January last year, or November, December the year before, to basically say LSE should sort this out, and part of that is hiring a specific member of staff to deal with it. We have got that agreed. There is going to be a member of staff hired on a full-time basis to oversee it, and that's a really brilliant first step. And that is going to improve the, you know, there are examples of students making reports and never hearing anything back. You know, you've been through an incident, you take your time to speak to someone about it, they help you write this report on the Report It, Stop It system, and then it goes nowhere. You never hear back from it. And that's disgusting lack of responsibility from LSE. The people I work with at LSE would say that definitely won't happen anymore. I'm not 100% satisfied that definitely won't happen anymore. There isn't clear process mapping around the way we support students in this area. And it's all kind of, it works if people do their job right, and you don't know whether people do their jobs right, aside from them telling you they have. So it's a bit of a mess. This role will come in, going to be called anti-harassment support advisor rather than ISFA, but it essentially covers the same sort of stuff. And then we're pushing for some broader work to be done around it, which will do some of that process mapping, look at what, I mean, this, all of the, this stuff sounds simple, but it comes down to resourcing, whose job is it? Are they being paid enough to do it? Do they have enough staff supporting with it? Is it a big enough part of their job role? And we're going to try and answer those questions to make sure that LSE does have a really excellent policy on this. I would say at the moment, it's certainly subpar at best.
Thank you for bringing that up. I wanted to just talk about something that was in your manifesto last year regarding LSE divesting from fossil fuels and armaments, because I know that like also a few years ago, I think in 2015 or 16, there was a motion about it. And just for students who, you know, who are first or second years who don't really know what's going on, can you update us on the sort of situation and what you managed to do this year?
Really good question. So I've learned a lot about what divestment means and what meaningful divestment looks like since coming into the role. I have, as GenSec, I have the privileged position. I sit on the investment subcommittee of the Finance and Estates Committee of LSE Council, which is LSE's governing body.
Wow, say that again.
And so what the investment subcommittee is the group that is a mixture of the kind of LSE management and the governors. And if either of you ever get into corporate governance stuff, this will make a lot more sense, but I'll save you the kind of boring lecture on it. Essentially, Minutia's bosses are the governors. And it's a mixture of the governors and management. And they manage the school's investments through the investment subcommittee. Now, there's a lot going on here. LSE, we all think LSE is really rich, and we talk about LSE being really rich, and it's got some brilliant assets. You know, Bankside is in the region, Bankside House, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this actually, but it's a lot of millions it's worth. Like, lots of money is on LSE's balance sheet. But it doesn't really matter. You're not going to, they can't just sell Bankside. That could take years to happen. LSE has actually quite a small amount of cash in the scheme, in the grand scheme of universities. Like, to you or I, it'd be enormous sums, but for universities it's quite low, which means they don't have a dedicated asset management team. They use fund managers to allocate, to make their investments for them. But the fund managers don't do it in a bespoke fashion. So they don't come up with a particular plan for LSE. They have their preset investment portfolios and they use LSE's cash to go into those funds. That means the amount of control LSE has over where its money goes is kind of limited, because they don't have enough cash to say to the fund managers, you've got to do what I say, because the fund managers say we'll get lost. You know, you've only got however many millions. If you want to say stuff like that, you need to be in the hundreds and hundreds of millions kind of thing. So that limits their ability to influence things. But LSE is still doing things. And myself and Ellie, the Environment, Fire and Ethics Officer, have been trying to hold them to account in this, that there are the best practice approach for divestment is not necessarily to fully divest from fossil fuel and armament, to fully divest from armament companies and divest from organizations that are part of the fossil fuel industry pipeline. But what you're looking for is investment in organizations that are showing a strategic plan to decarbonize their operations. And that is a way of the market encouraging economic actors like companies that are traded publicly to move the way they operate away from fossil fuel intensive work into more renewable sources. And it goes in all sorts of different kind of ways. LSE has a policy, which means they should have no more than, I think, 3% exposure to companies that are classed as fossil fuel and armament companies. Because that isn't quite in LSE's full control, it's a bit complicated about how they get there, but they're broadly able to operate in that space. I hope it's not too boring.
No, it's good. It's good to hear all of this because we don't know this.
Yeah, and where and I've not done a very good job explaining it. One of the one of the things I've been trying to put pressure on the school to do, they are doing good stuff and it's reasonable. And it's not, you know, divestment isn't simple. It just really isn't. But it sounds simple. It sounds like, how could you invest in a fossil fuel company? Just don't do it. They don't tell the story of what they're trying to do well enough and put pressure on. And so I've been trying to get them to do some of that storytelling. And there are members of that investment subcommittee who are quite keen that we do the storytelling, but they're not the majority. The majority are kind of thinking, how do we just get more money? Can we just make more money? And to kind of bring this to a close, what will be really interesting and where the school will be able to take some really significant leadership in the area of environmental, social and governance investment, which is what this is if they have a much larger endowment. That's the word for the kind of assets that the school has, is the cash assets, is endowment. If it gets a much bigger one, it will be able to be a much more significant actor in this area. You compare LSE to some of the big American universities.
Yeah.
And they...
Yeah, just compare.
The endowment for, I heard anecdotally, the endowment for not a university, not a department, but a research centre, I think the University of Pennsylvania, a research centre, so a tiny slice, has a larger endowment than LSE has. And that puts it into perspective. And what will be really interesting is if LSE is able to grow its endowment, which will benefit the students of LSE and the LSE community, it will also be able to be a much stronger economic actor in making change in the environmental, social governance investing. And because we've got the Grantham Institute, if we can match those things together, you know, there's a view where we could become one of the foremost sustainable investors in higher education and producing research on how to do that throughout the economy, not just in HE. I'm going to take a breath now.
No, that was great. That was really, really good to hear. And very interesting, actually, to think about it all from these different angles. Thank you for that. Thank you. So lots of the representatives that we actually spoke to at the start of the year, when they just got their roles in their various bits, they told us that they wanted to hear more from the students, obviously, and they felt that there was a breakdown of communication typically between the SU and students, and a lot of students maybe doubting the real power that the SU has. In light of this, I mean, you said that COVID had helped this because you can predict more what students are thinking generally, but how well do you think the SU is able to represent students' concerns?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there are some structural issues. I think within the union, there is an attitude that student voice is owned by sabbatical officers. And I think that's a completely wrong approach. I think student voice is owned by the students and we need to be listening to the students. Interestingly, that shouldn't be the responsibility of sabbatical officers to make sure the union is listening to students. I think that should be an organisationally led approach to making sure that we have channels for feedback. We're focus grouping with students to ask them, you know, there are some issues we know are big issues. We know that what assessments look like is really important, and the policies that sit around assessments, like the fit sit policy, exceptional circumstances, policy appeals, stuff like that. We know that decolonising the curriculum is a big piece of work that has very strong support across the student body, consent education, there's so many things that we know are big issues. We don't talk to students enough as an organisation to understand how they would like that to be done. And I think the typical dynamic is for the staff members to go to the officer team to try and get the answer to these questions. And you're elected as an officer on your manifesto, which maybe has, you know, between 5 and 10 key points, maybe only 3 of which you really, really understand and know what you're talking about. And as an officer, you're looking for a bit more support from the union. And what I would like to see is the union having a much better understanding of what students think, because the union talks to them, without necessitating that to be done by the sabbatical officers. Because it's a whirlwind experience to be a sabbatical officer, and it's quite tough. And it can actually be quite tough to even work out who to talk to, how to talk to students, to really work out what they think is going on. And I think the union could play a much bigger role in that. And like you mentioned, that I mentioned, it is something that the pandemic has helped. Students have got in touch a lot more. It's not just that we're able to predict better what's going on in students' minds, it's that students are telling us. There was that petition that we put out as a kind of, at the beginning of January, on hardship funding, tuition fees and halls. And that was really interesting. We had over 4,000 signatures, which represents over a third of the LSE student body. That was a really good and clear indication of where students' heads were at that moment in time and really helped us go forward. We then had a town hall off the back of the petition with 300 students attending. That's unheard of levels of engagement. And so the pandemic brought that partly because we speculatively kind of went, are these the things that you're really concerned about? They were the things students were really concerned about. But then we got engaged in a dialogue about it. But again, that was all sabbatical officer led. The union, in my view, needs to move to a place where student voice isn't just sabbatical officers, it's the whole student body. And yes, we've got union general meetings and motions, which are supposed to fulfill that function. They don't. We're lucky if we have two people attend a union general meeting, right? So it's just not really fit for purpose, and we need to be more creative. And I know that next year's officer team will have the opportunity to do a democracy review, which looks at how we listen to our students, hopefully in some innovative ways that go beyond a union general meeting. Maybe even we scrap union general meetings. Maybe you've never heard of one. That would be good. Sorry, I hope I've kind of answered your question in that.
No, definitely you have, yeah.
Right, so moving from, you know, that, and since you talked about the next sabbatical officers, what do you think are the challenges that the incoming team, regardless of who they are, what will be the biggest challenge they will face in the coming year?
So the absolute biggest challenge is that they're all new, I think. And I think that's great. I think I had reservations about running for a second time, because I think there's real benefit in having people who are closer to the student body, understand what's going on. I think the next year's team, you definitely want people who've been through this year of education at LSE. I haven't been in an online lecture, for example. That's a way in which I'm disconnected. So they'll have that benefit, but what they won't have as much as is helpful is that real understanding of how the union works and how LSE works and how you can make those quick wins. You know, through the benefit of my time in the SU, I know where to go if I've got a question or if I think something needs to happen. I have those relationships with staff at the school. And I think the new team won't have that. The current team will do all we can to equip them. The staff team will do all they can to equip them, but it's a steep learning curve. And so I think that will be one of the biggest challenges. In terms of other challenges, and maybe this is me just being a bit like, we've had a pretty shit year this year. I don't think they'll have loads of challenges. I think they're going to have all of the fun that my generation hasn't been able to have. I think hopefully, like we mentioned earlier, the vaccine rollout is effective. They're, if there's social distancing, it's for minimal periods of time. It doesn't kind of plague the university experience. I think they're going to have such an opportunity to bring a sense of fun back to the student experience, to really empower students with that experience. I think to that end, the biggest challenge will just be readjusting to that new context that is hopefully closer to normal. And maybe the challenge there is that it's quite hard to actually see yourself as a leader, particularly when we're so young in these roles, and for them to feel able to take that leadership and set the vision for the union that they want to set will be quite tough. That's something I found quite tough. And so maybe that will be a challenge, and that relates to the fact that they will have to learn a lot about how to sort of succeed in their roles at the same time. But hopefully not too challenging. Definitely, I hope it's less challenging than this year's been.
So this is a bit of a wild card question, but I think you're gonna run with it. As a former student, a previous SU officer, and now, you know, with the experience of being the general secretary, what is the downside for students who study at LSE, or indeed want to study at LSE, that they can tackle for themselves, something that can't be tackled other than by them? What would you say is the biggest sort of dilemma that faces every student at LSE?
God, that's such an interesting question. I'm going to take a few moments to think about it so I can run with it.
That's great. You can.
Yeah. Because it's interesting. There's this tension between I'm super optimistic and everything to a fault. I believe we can get more things done than we perhaps actually can get done. And with that in mind, I think a lot of the issues LSE students face, things can be done to influence them, to have a better experience and to nudge them in those directions. One of the things that has been a bit of a theme, particularly in my time as community and welfare officer, when I really learned, you know, going from being a student to looking at the broader view of the student body and what they do, LSE students are exceptional, not just individually, but collectively. You go to a drama society production, it's one of the best things you will see, genuinely. That is across the board in all of our clubs and societies, campaigns, everything. LSE students have this ability to just be so brilliant. And it's almost being in the SU, I'm like, sad I'm not part of that thing that's excellent. I'm sort of sat off to the side on top, not quite engaged in it, which is a bit of a weird one. But with that in mind, and this is obviously stuff the SU and the school can do, is making students feel empowered to take those opportunities, to join the communities that exist. I think the thing that is truly in students' control is how much they engage and what they choose to engage in. There are students who will spend their time at LSE, they'll have a few friends, but they won't reach out into the bigger community groups that exist. And I think for those people, they're really missing out on something. Like, you guys are both part of the Beaver. That's, I'm sure, hopefully for you, a great experience of really cool people doing something you'd never do, building skills that, yes, are going to help you in your future, but actually are just quite good to have, build your awareness of what's going on. And I think choosing to get involved and stuck in those kinds of things, no one can make you do that. That is in your own control as a student. And sometimes there are real battles going on that hold you back. But where students are able to, I think that's probably the best thing they can do, is just get stuck in. And maybe further to that, there are a million negative things to say about the SU and the university, and sometimes I'm the one saying them. But if you really don't like it, and if you really think there are ways things can be done better, tell people and go and make them better and make it happen. And that's one of the things we do see a lot of students do. Those would be my two thoughts, I think. Get involved and change the things you think need to be changed.
Yeah. Thanks for those answers, because I think, you know, first of all, it's really useful for students who might, you know, be coming to LSE or people who are still at LSE. And second of all, when we have these conversations, I always think that we're always talking about what the LSE can do, what the SU can do. But truth is, student engagement in sort of SU initiatives is mostly low. So it's kind of, you know, ultimately, it's in the students' hands sometimes to act and participate themselves.
And to kind of build on that, something that I really got affirmed to me, and I think maybe happens when you step out of being a student into the working world, you have to just get started. Like, there was a lot of time I spent in both community and welfare officer and GenSec waiting for something to happen, waiting for, you know, a group of staff to come along and support me with a project and hold my hand through it. And that didn't happen. Or just, you know, waiting. If we believe things can be done in a certain way, we have to be the ones who make it happen. And we have to get started. And this also speaks to some of the leadership challenges I think will exist for the next team. You have to just get going and you have to pick a direction and start off in that direction. But the inertia can be a bit tough. And I think that's true of SU officers, but also students sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, we have two final questions. The first one is, what was most difficult for you this year, like overall?
Too many things, guys. There's too many things.
Or like a frustration, something.
No, I've really struggled this year. I've experienced my own challenge, like everyone has struggled throughout the pandemic, and my experience of GenSec has been marred by that. I think the peak of it, God, I almost had a bit of a breakdown, to be honest, was around September, October. It had been a long summer of what the fuck is going on? How on earth are we supposed to do this? I felt incredibly isolated. And it comes back to this, the point I was just making about inertia. I really wanted support from colleagues in the SU that I felt I wasn't getting. The SU is set up at least in part to support officers to help them achieve what they want to achieve. And it felt like that wasn't really happening. And I found that really tough, like really, really tough. I was doing a lot of stuff off with LSE that was trying to influence quite important decisions about the way university life was going to proceed in the pandemic context. And I felt a bit left to get on with it. Whereas what an ideal scenario is, I'm empowered by colleagues in the SU, they're supporting me through that experience. And in particular, I think if you spoke to my fellow officers, they'd agree. It felt a little bit like I ran the induction process because I was a second year officer. That added this pressure that was also quite tough to deal with. And I remember, you know, my parents are really lucky that I have them to speak to about this stuff. I'm talking to them and getting really pissed off at them because all my mum kept telling me is, David, this is a leadership exercise. You have to go and make this. And I was not ready at that moment to accept that if I wanted to see a change, I had to be the one who made the change happen. And I found that really tough because I was kind of thinking, but there are all these people who are supposed to help me get there. And it felt like I was being asked to change them, but myself. And I found that really tough. But it was actually the support of one of my flatmates. We talked about it a lot. And he kind of said, the way you're going, your frustrations are valid and it makes sense, but you could easily end up wasting your year of GenSec over them. Is that what you want to do? And he was kind of the right voice at the right time to really help me get over that and think about, like, do you know what? Yeah, I need to get over the fact that I have a view about how things should be done. I need to go and get them done in that way, if that's what I want. And that really helped. And then more recently, I've been, so that's the biggest one. That was like, fuck my life. This is so hard. And compounding with not just my personal ambition for the role, but I really feel the duty and responsibility to do things right for students. And I'm not going to do everything right all the time. I hope that in my efforts, I land on a few things that are good enough. Mm. But that, you know, this is a privilege to be elected into these paid positions like this. And I personally feel such a responsibility to do a good job to that end. And that kind of just intensified how tough it was. So that was the really tough bit. Then on top of that, with you may have come across the National Campaign on Tuition Fees, SUAF, Students Unite Against Fees. It's so hard. It's so hard. I'm in this position where I'm kind of coordinating this national campaign. I'm working with student unions across the country. I've got a vision, but I don't want it to just be my vision for the campaign. I want us all to share and collaborate in it. But I haven't found the space yet where I've made it so that people feel they can share that vision. And it doesn't matter how many times I tell people, go and, like, if you have an idea, we can just go and do it. Tell us and we'll make it happen kind of thing. People are still looking to me in some way. And what I found tough is this sense of, this is quite an important campaign. The students need to be heard on a national level, that the argument being made, they deserve compensation on their fees. That needs to happen, isn't happening. And this campaign might just be the best bet at getting that to happen. But I'm stuck thinking, we're not going anywhere because I've not found the thing that will get people to really engage and take share ownership of the campaign in that. I've maybe come up with a plan that might work, but I was finding it really tough, feeling again this sense of responsibility that, you know, I'm the one who's called people together for this campaign and I'm not finding the way to make it work. At the same time as this is really important to get right. You know, not just LSE students, but students broadly would be done a disservice if a campaign like this doesn't succeed. And so feeling that pressure has been quite tough. So I've given you a whole bunch of stuff in that. I hope that's okay.
Feel free to, like, update us on the situation. I mean, if you are involved in it, maybe you can, like, tell us. Because I've been receiving updates on it regularly from the SU, actually. But if you have anything that you would like to share about the situation right now, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Oh, God, there's it's funny. There's both lots going on and nothing going on. You know, from the perspective of people engaged in the campaign, oh, loads are going on. We're talking about lots of stuff. We're talking to all these stakeholders. But from my perspective, in quite a student-facing way, nothing's really happening. There haven't been mass actions that people have been able to get behind. And that's that part of the frustrations I've experienced in not being able to make that go ahead. There's been some really interesting political conversations with the NUS, who are taking the line that they don't believe we should be fighting for fee compensation this year. For a whole host of reasons. That's been very interesting. I am working with a few groups in the sector, chiefly, namely the Russell Group, to see if we can identify a joint line, maybe not on fee compensation, but on financial support for students. That would go some way to dignifying the just awful experience students have been having this year. That they're still paying for large amounts, but not getting. So we've been working on that front. And I think the space that the SUAF campaign is in is trying to lead and support by helping provide the framework for fee strikes and for unions to support fee strikers. And I think that's a space we're trying to enter. And so in the specific LSE context, we're trying to organise a fee strike for those students who want to strike. I don't pay fees. I graduated in 2019. It would be awful for me to do anything more than perhaps support and encourage people to consider striking. It has to be a very personal decision. But for those students who want to, I think they deserve to be to see an organised fee strike go on. We're trying to make that happen. And we're trying to use the national campaign to facilitate that on a national scale, because I think that's probably the best bet at getting this argument made nationally. We've also, this is a bit funny, there was a BBC article like a month ago that talked about someone from London Economics who'd done fee modelling. And I read it and I thought, oh, LSE, fee modelling, I should get in touch with them, they're LSE. They weren't LSE, they were London Economics, which is this complete other thing, but I'd made a mistake, so I decided to reach out to them anyway. And they've ended up on a mostly pro bono basis doing modelling for the campaign, which looks at various scenarios of fee compensation. And it's the headline that fee compensation to be meaningful has to be incredibly expensive is what we've learned. I think we did already know that, but we've also been able to look at some other, it's basically revealed just how broken the tuition fee system is, just how much any movements you do, it's hard for it not to basically end up benefiting white men. Any kind of compensation you do through student loans ends up giving them the best benefit with little else for other groups. And that's been quite fascinating. But yeah, we've got a lot of people involved in the campaign. It's known nationally in the SU world. Got thousands of students signed up to it. But really trying to find that thing that is going to take us from, yeah, people know about it and some people are involved in it, to we're actually a force with a voice that is being heard nationally.
All right. And overall, you know, considering being the SU's general secretary this year, but maybe also including your work as community and welfare officer, what was the most rewarding part of everything, of like representing the students in the SU?
The people I've got to work with. I love people. I love working with people. In particular, the two sabbatical officer teams I've had the just absolute pleasure and joy to learn from, learn with, become friends with. That, without a doubt, has been the best part of being an officer, is the solidarity we've faced together, particularly in the context of the pandemic, I think might also be part of it. The way I've been so impressed and privileged to be parts of those teams with people who are totally dedicated to doing their best for students and trying to make real change happen. It's been fortunate that broadly our political views have aligned, our beliefs about what should be different at LSE have aligned, and where they haven't, we've had a good enough relationships with each other to for the, then them not to be massive issues. So it's that. But then, so I said something a little bit weird when I got elected as community and welfare officer. I came up on stage and I said something really sort. I said, I've been humbled. Thank you, LSE. And that's a slight, you know, it's a little bit odd wording behind something. But that, I don't know, maybe I'm like weirdly patriotic or I just super believe in democracy or something like that. But there is some sense of feeling empowered by the community of LSE that I think has stuck with me throughout my time. And both that's been this slightly pressurizing responsibility to do well for students, but also this amazing privileged experience where I have been given this position to do good on behalf of students. And there is something so, just so quite, I guess, validating about that. I think empowering is the word. It almost feels a bit like being trusted on quite a broad level. I think that's been fantastic. And as like a third part, I'd be remiss if I didn't say students are both the best and worst bit. You know, some students, in the context that I meet them, they're not the best interactions, but that's the minority. Most of the time, students are just the absolute best thing about it, about this job. And I don't think I could enjoy any part of it if I didn't truly believe in doing better for LSE students, because I think they're fundamentally really good people and just great to be a part of this community, even if I am occasionally finding myself a bit separate from it in this SU space.
No, that's great to hear. Thank you so much.
Feel free to like update us on the situation. I mean, if you are involved in it, maybe you can like tell us, because I've been receiving updates on it regularly from the SU actually, but if you have anything that you would like to share about the situation right now, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Oh God, it's funny. There's both lots going on and nothing going on. You know, from the perspective of people engaged in the campaign, oh, loads are going on. We're talking about lots of stuff. We're talking to all these stakeholders. But from my perspective, in quite a student-facing way, nothing's really happening. There haven't been mass actions that people have been able to get behind. And that's part of the frustrations I've experienced in not being able to make that go ahead. There's been some really interesting political conversations with the NUS, who are taking the line that they don't believe we should be fighting for fee compensation this year for a whole host of reasons. That's been very interesting. I am working with a few groups in the sector, chiefly, namely the Russell Group, to see if we can identify a joint line, maybe not on fee compensation, but on financial support for students, that would go some way to dignifying the just awful experience students have been having this year, that they're still paying for large amounts, but not getting. So we've been working on that front. And I think the space that the SUAF campaign is in is trying to lead and support by helping provide the framework for fee strikes and for unions to support fee strikers. And I think that's a space we're trying to enter. And so in the specific LSE context, we're trying to organize a fee strike for those students who want to strike. I don't pay fees. I graduated in 2019. It would be awful for me to do anything more than perhaps support and encourage people to consider striking. It has to be a very personal decision. But for those students who want to, I think they deserve to see an organised fee strike go on. We're trying to make that happen. And we're trying to use the national campaign to facilitate that on a national scale, because I think that's probably the best bet at getting this argument made nationally. We've also, this is a bit funny, there was a BBC article like a month ago that talked about someone from London Economics who'd done fee modelling. And I read it and I thought, oh, LSE, fee modelling, I should get in touch with them, they're LSE. They weren't LSE, they were London Economics, which is this complete other thing, but I'd made a mistake, so I decided to reach out to them anyway. And they've ended up on a mostly pro bono basis doing modelling for the campaign, which looks at various scenarios of fee compensation. And it's the headline that fee compensation to be meaningful has to be incredibly expensive is what we've learned. I think we did already know that, but we've also been able to look at some other, it's basically revealed just how broken the tuition fee system is, just how much it, any movements you do, it's hard for it not to basically end up benefiting white men. If any kind of compensation you do through student loans ends up giving them the best benefit with little else for other groups. And that's been quite fascinating. But yeah, we've got a lot of people involved in the campaign. It's known nationally in the SU world, got thousands of students signed up to it, but really trying to find that thing that is going to take us from, yeah, people know about it and some people are involved in it, to we're actually a force with a voice that is being heard nationally.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think we can only say like a big, big thank you for this after taking up almost 1 hour. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. The music for this podcast was produced by Ash Lyo Musing, and Maisie and I have been your hosts. For more information on Beaver Sound, check out our social media and website.